could use for biodiesel.
I'm sure you don't want Cisco peanut butter and stuff.
No, I got my own freshly ground corn.
Here, but I'm a vegetable and berry specialist for the state half time. And then right now I'm coordinator of the Northeast SARE program, which is USDA program, Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education. Gives out $3 million in grants every year. Grants just for farmers, there's grants for scientists, there's grants for educators. So I split between those two. And I used to run the Center for Sustainable Ag at UVM.
What happened to that?
I switched to giving out money instead of trying to get money.
There you go. There you go.
A lot more fun.
One of the things I've always appreciated about Vern is that the work that he does, I think, overlaps nicely with a lot of student interests at Marlborough College. There's no way that he could ever be just berry and vegetable specialist in the state, and you'll see this from the talk he's going to give today that includes energy in the mix. So thanks for coming.
Sure, good to be here.
And Vern mentioned too that he's happy to take questions.
Yeah, I don't mind being interrupted. I have a lot of slides, a lot of pictures of what's happening on the farm. Basically, I work with farmers on the ground mostly, trying to make good things happen. That's what Extension is about, giving people information to make good decisions and hopefully change something. Make it better, whether it's making more money, taking better care of the water or the soil or labor or energy. And issues are always changing, so that's the fun thing about Extension. You never do the same thing. You keep trying to, a lot of cases, just keep up with the farmers. So there is kind of this model of early adopters. So there's some really smart, innovative farmers that often lead the way, and then we try and keep up, and then we kind of pass on info to others who are next level down, kind of waiting to see what other people do. And then you have like the really recalcitrant people at the end that never want to change, and you compete on them. Still trying to get them to do things that we were 20 years ago. It's soil test or whatever. So I got into this whole thing actually because I got a grant to do education on climate change and agriculture for people in extension, other educators. Essentially, I went to a scientific conference, the American Society of Wort Sciences in Providence, and you know, number one environmental issue of our time. There are all these non-disturbed ecosystem scientists. That's one of the things about agriculture is we get separated sometimes from ecology or other more pure scientists because we work in disturbed environments. That's how you grow food unless you want to be a hunter-gatherer. And it was just shown so compelling all of the things that actually were going to have practical applications, effects on rainfall, temperature, species migration, both pests, and also how you know different cultivars and types of crops are going to start moving around. And then when I came back and checked it out, there really was no outreach program. That's extension is outreach for farmers about any of this. So we spent a year trying to figure out, well, how would you even broach that topic without just like telling people to go beat their head against the wall because it's so big or feeling like they were at fault. And long story short, this is what I came to, is that renewable energy is the hook for climate change for people like farmers because there's something they can do about it. And some real positive things, actually. And it's kind of at the center of this thing about trying to remain profitable when there's all these moving targets of markets and labor and regulation. Doing something good for the climate by using above ground carbon or you know non-carbon sources, like I'll show you some wind things. And then peak oil kind of started to really take off. It's just interesting the past year or two how climate change went from sort of marginal with a lot of people I work with and peak oil no one had even heard of. Suddenly, people know what these things are and there's just been a huge amount of change in the last couple of years. And a lot of it spurred by a really kind of small jump in you know energy price. Yeah, it was a third of the price of gas, but it was $1 a gallon. Europe, they've been paying $6 a gallon for a long time. So I actually took that as a very optimistic thing, that a little blip in prices just motivated all of this innovation and activity. And it's not like the energy crisis of the 70s that people get this whole peak oil thing, that you know we really are running out of fossil fuels. And long, you know, in a nutshell, we've used the first half of what's in the ground, the first trillion barrels, and there's another trillion barrels left, and it's harder to get, both geologically and politically. So we're going to be in a different energy world in the not too distant future. And I'm not, you know, arguing about the exact dates or quantities. These are all the sources of fossil fuels. And we won't really know when the peak was, except looking backwards. But it's sometime around now, plus or minus 5 years. And people get this, and I've had a farmer say to me the other day, well, I'm not betting on the internal combustion engine for the next generation. That's kind of an outrageous thing to say when you're surrounded by internal combustion engines for your entire operation.
Where did you get this graph?
This I plucked off of one of the peak oil sites. At the end, I'm going to end with kind of a comprehensive website. It's climateandfarming.org. It's all the climate science and renewable energy, both presentations that we put together and links and stuff. But I don't have a lot of citations as we go here. But this is, I can get it for you. So, you know, there's no point arguing about climate change either. So I don't want to waste my time. It's happening. Actually, the work, the people that were on that project with me, especially the UNH Climate Science Center showed, it's been happening for 100 years. The climate of New England has warmed by 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit on average. Precipitation is way more erratic, and there's just so much data, and then there's also applied data. The lilacs and apples are flowering a week early, the lakes are icing out, the ice is melting a week early, the stream flow, peak flows have moved. It goes on and on and on of things that are totally data substantiated. And then there's a lot of anecdotal things. Farmers say to me, Northern New Hampshire, well, we never saw a Japanese beetle until 5 years ago. Now, is that just climate or migration? Or, I mean, things you can't always pinpoint the causes, but there's a lot that's happening, and they've gone back 600,000 years looking in the little bubbles in ice cores, seeing the CO2 levels. So we haven't had these kind of levels since the dinosaurs roamed the earth. So what do you do with that? Well, for the farmers, there's two things. One is adaptation. Get ready for some changes. Like we know precipitation is going to be more erratic. So that means having good irrigation for when it's dry and having better drainage for when it's wet. And we're already seeing that, you know, 200-year floods up north in the last 5 years. And so that's one thing we can sort of preach, and pest management. A lot of it reinforces good practices. We have IPM, which is scouting for pests to know when they're there. So since things are moving around, it makes sense to be out there looking for them and looking for things you haven't seen before. So that reinforces a good practice. And then there's kind of this greater public good thing. Okay, how can I do my part? As I mentioned, we're not blaming ag. Ag is actually a very small contributor to the total. It's like 2% of the total greenhouse gas equivalents, which surprised me how low it really is. But farmers are in a unique position to lead the way because they're naturally innovative. They can tinker. They have all these resources at their hand. They put stuff together, and that's what you'll see. The average homeowner isn't going to say, oh, I think I'll heat my house on vegetable oil. I mean, there are people doing that, but not your average, whereas there's a much greater proportion of farmers who say, well, I'm going to change my energy scene here, and they go out and do something. So they are this whole early adopter thing that's leading the way for the rest of society. So when you look at one analysis of greenhouse gas output by farms, and this is an analysis of the entire New York dairy industry, 700,000 cows, and everything is in carbon dioxide equivalents. So you have to do that, and I don't know how much everybody knows about climate science, but you know, there's a whole bunch of different gases up there. Some are warming the planet, some are cooling the planet. It's a very complicated thing to understand. But for my purposes, I focus on the gases generated by agriculture. CO2 is the one everyone is generating when you combust any kind of fuel. But the other important one is methane, which comes from anaerobic digestion of manure or from things like enteric methane. CH4 is methane. That's cow farts and burps in plain language. And that's because you have an anaerobic digestion system going on in the stomachs. Methane is 21 times more powerful than CO2 as a greenhouse gas. So that's where the equivalents come in. One unit of methane counts as 21 CO2s. And then nitrous oxide down here, N2O, is 210 times more powerful than CO2. So where that gets interesting is when you take fertilizer, and where is that? On here, nitrogen, so it's in the feed. So the nitrogen fertilizer is, there's two really big contributions to climate change that it makes. One is it's energy intensive to make. It's made from natural gas. And the other thing is when it goes anaerobic in the ground, when there's not oxygen, it goes to nitrous oxide and can come up in the air. So it's a bad actor in this whole scene. So this analysis, for me, all this shows is there's a bunch of stuff that's either not that big or we can't do anything about. You can't. We've done a good job in optimizing the feed on cows already. We can't really change the fact that they give off methane. The only real answer to that is having less cows. And that's, you know, I'm not going to get into that argument. But some areas we can have a big reduction is reducing the amount of nitrogen that's used to produce the feed. That's nitrogen fertilizer. So a fifth of all the greenhouse gas equivalents is fertilizer, nitrogen fertilizer. And most of it probably isn't needed. And the other place is manure management. So when you throw manure on the ground and stuff evaporates, or it's in a lagoon and it's anaerobic and giving off methane, that's another area that is fairly easy to attack. So together, there's about a third of the impact that we know what. You know, we know how to manage that now. So the thing that's not on here, well, a couple other things. One is, I was kind of surprised how little energy, proportionally, is in the moving stuff around. So moving the feed in and moving the milk out, each are only 1% of the total impact. You think, oh, those trucks, well, it doesn't total up. It's a fairly efficient system for how much is moving. And the reality is, the milk isn't going that far. It's still in the Northeast. That's what it comes out to. And electricity is pretty high. Now, where there are some differences are like in the clientele I work with. So a typical vegetable and berry farmer in Vermont might have 30, 40, 50 acres, 2, 3, 5, 10, 15 greenhouses, depending on how many flowers and bedding plants, etc. So a lot of the guys I work with burn 3, 5, 7,000 gallons of heating oil or propane equivalent every winter, mostly spring, from like February to May to heat their greenhouse. So that doesn't show up on a dairy farm. That's a big chunk of energy, and that's where you'll see a bunch of the innovations coming is, okay, here's one targeted thing. How do I heat my greenhouses with renewable energy? That's like, if we were gonna start someplace, there's a really good place. You can also put stuff in tractors, but they're not, there they are, you know, 7%. So that's a chunk, that piece. So if we're putting biodiesel in the tractors, that would help. So these are the things I'm gonna show you about. So some things are not really considered in a commonplace way as being renewable energy, but I just mentioned how much of an impact the nitrogen fertilizer is having. So if we could grow legumes, could supply our nitrogen that way, you know, that's a form of renewable energy in a strange kind of way. And here's a farmer in southern New Hampshire, Ira Rutila, longtime organic farmer. I mean, he hasn't applied fertilizer on his farm, nitrogen fertilizer, in probably 25 years.
Where is he?
He is in, it's near and outside of Nashua, New Hampshire. He's on good soil, it's a good climate, but you can see this is hairy vetch. It's a lush nodule, a lush legume that nodulates. He uses hairy vetch primarily and field peas. But there's alfalfa, there's clovers, there's, we know, lots of different green manures that can be used. So this is full, this is like 4% nitrogen dry weight. You plow it under, you can provide upwards of 100 pounds of nitrogen to a crop that follows. So that's doable. I mean, you have to take the time and the land to grow this stuff, and that's one of the issues for some farmers. And then there's the whole distribution system. So this is in Brattleboro. This used to be Northeast Co-ops. Now empty, because it's bought by United Foods, which is a whole other story of it's all getting bigger and bigger and bigger, but most of our food moves in trucks like this around the country. I was just down in near Nogales, in, outside of Tucson, Arizona. In the winter, most of the East Coast vegetables come from Mexico, and they come through that town. So they've already come 1,000 miles before they get the border. Now they're coming another 3,000. Any idea how many tractor trailers of vegetables every day comes through that town?
1,000.
Close? More.
2,000.
Yeah, 1,600 tractor trailers a day of vegetables come through there. Each one, essentially, the content's going to go, you know, 2,000 to 3,000 to 4,000 miles. Then they get dropped off, they get refrigerated, and they get put onto American trucks. The plant I visited does 100,000 boxes a day, which is like 30, 40 pounds of vegetables. They spend $30,000 a week on electricity refrigerating those. That's just to get it from one truck to the other. They only stay there one day. So just that, I'm just saying the whole energy in the system is so mind-boggling that sometimes like energy on the farm is sort of a so what. Now you didn't see that in the milk, but they were just counting the milk truck. What happens to the milk in the factory and then getting back on the truck, going back to the stores and refrigerated in the stores is a whole other. So what's interesting is in the middle isn't so great, like a box truck, which is like a sort of a big size pickup truck, going hundreds of miles is far less efficient than a fully loaded semi on the highway, has so much more food in it. But the little pickup going down the road to farmer's market is much more efficient. So it isn't totally about size and scale is what I'm saying. It's about energy per unit of food. So moving a lot of food together in a you know, an efficient way, it gets complicated. But a totally local system does make sense. In other words, so if you can milk the cow, you know, put it in a bottle and sell it to somebody down the road, or that is a huge offset from all the stuff that has to happen to it with refrigeration and packaging and stuff like that.
Do you have any comparisons that have side by side between
farmer's market? A grad student named David Timmons, who I was working with, he was at UVM and now he's getting his doctorate at UMass, and he wrote a paper I can can give you on that. It's a tough thing to totally get a handle on, but he made a good stab at it. And there's a paper out of England too that he cites a lot. I mean, one thing is when you get into rail and barge, those are actually very efficient ways to move things.
Mm-hmm.
So again, you know, there's a whole bunch of other issues too, like we're moving people off the land from subsistence farming in Mexico to grow vegetables for, you know, external landowners. So that's why we have an immigration problem. I mean, it's complicated. All right, now what I'm supposed to talk to, which is renewable energy. So there's a bunch of things we think about, and for the farmers, it often starts with the money. What's it going to cost me, and when will it be paid off? And of course, that hinges in large part on what the cost of the energy is that you're displacing. Where can I get the energy, and how sustainable is that? So there's been a lot of interest in burning corn, for example. I'll show you a few slides. Well, corn is kind of artificially low cost because of our whole ag economics in this country, and you know, there's some hesitancy to invest in a system that burns corn, even though it's cheap now. If policies were to change, it might not be so cheap. And then the last two are sort of these are commonly used. So the cost is common. Then this fossil fuel ratio. For every unit of fossil energy I put in, how many units of energy do I get out? And that's a really important analysis in the scheme of things, and also sometimes a tough one to do. But if it takes me a gallon of diesel to make 3 gallons of biodiesel, which is roughly what it is out west, is that sustainable? I mean, I don't know. It's good. You're getting some return. Ethanol, corn ethanol, is pretty close to a wash. It's like 1.06 to 1. There's like, depending on who use the numbers you look at, there's not much return on investment because it takes so much energy to grow the corn, to fertilize the corn, to harvest it, to process it. So we're actually, the system being pushed the most, which is ethanol right now, is like the least return on energy investment. And then greenhouse gas emissions, which I just showed you a whole slide of. Which the fascinating thing to me is these don't always align. So one may look good money-wise, and sometimes, like with ethanol, it's because the government has a policy that's giving subsidies to it. Or even, and I'll show you some real examples of this too, the fossil fuel ratio might be really good, but greenhouse gas emission might be a wash. There's some analyses out of Cornell on corn ethanol, and especially no-till corn ethanol, and it's actually worse for greenhouse gases than just burning gas, because largely because of the fertilizer. So it's bad enough you burn all this diesel to grow the corn, but when you put nitrogen in the ground and you make nitrous oxide, which is so powerful, it's worse. So, and then this one, which is I'm just so interested in, because a lot of what I do is it's half social work and half technical. So if it doesn't fit the person's goals and lifestyle, it's just a non-starter. You can't, you know, we don't push recipes, we push options. Here's things to think about. People have to decide what they're gonna do. And I'll give you some clear examples of that. And it's not just, you know, money, it's people's technical abilities and also the resources you have. And one of the problems we get into is the farm's already up against the wall financially. I mean, it's not the time to take on a major change in the system, usually, because they're not going to have the wherewithal to do it. So these are all the ethanol plants that are under construction or planned in Iowa. And each little circle is where they will have to draw corn from to fuel the plant. So what conclusion would you draw from this graph?
It's a lot of driving.
A lot of driving,
a lot of corn,
a lot of
overlap.
Is there enough corn for all these plants?
No.
No. If all of these get built, Iowa would be a net importer of corn. I already grow something, I can't even remember how many billions of bushels of corn, they grow a lot of corn. So bad things will happen because before that, marginal lands start getting cropped to corn. The rotations start breaking down. Instead of corn, soy, you go corn, corn, soy, corn, 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 soy. And it just doesn't make sense. So I don't know that they'll all get built, but there's a big, big push. And this doesn't even show, the biodiesel plants are mostly run on soybeans. It's a different story. So the other thing is, this is a race to the bottom for a lot of farmers. It's a commodity price. They're all going to source corn as cheap as they can. So for the farmers I work with, Vermont is small. We can't compete economically really on anything. We don't have, we need some other angle in the market. It's either an identification at the brand or a consumer relationship or something. So that's where I'm coming from, is we need to decouple from this system because we'll get killed. And there are really two models. You know, are we going to be the source of energy for society, essentially producing a commodity to be converted to ethanol or biodiesel or something else, or to make energy for ourselves and our neighbors? And that's the model. This is where I see the promise. And a lot of it is what I call flying beneath the radar. We want to decouple from all the federal and regulatory things, the testing, the systems, the middlemen, this whole distribution system that all basically keeps farmers as indentured servants in many ways. So as far as an economic analysis, you can boil everything down into what's the cost of 1 million BTUs from your system? And you do it by taking the unit of energy, how many BTUs are in that unit, what does the unit cost, what's the efficiency of combusting it, of getting the BTUs out of it, and you multiply all those, and then you change. If the price of oil goes up, you raise that. If you have a more efficient furnace, you change that. And then we're plugging some things in that we don't know, like grass pellets. I'll show you some slides of those. They're not really an energy form yet that's available. We don't know what they're going to cost per unit. And stoves haven't really been developed, so we can guess. So I hate these things that I call precision without accuracy. I usually round things off. $17.86, I don't know. To me, it's $15 to $30 would be the, but it gives you, again, a lot of what we do is give people a framework to pencil things out. To say, okay, I know before I change my whole furnace over, it would have to go up to $3 to pay for it at this scenario. So let's go through some real examples of farms. But before that, I just pause because I talk a lot. If there's any questions.
What method does that 23 million BTU per cord of wood come from? Like, is that gasification or is it just burning?
That's, you're talking more about the method would be in this column. So a cord of hardwood has a certain amount of BTUs in it, period. Okay. The type of wood, ash versus pine, hardwood's going to have more BTUs than not. So that, you're already rounding a number there. But the wood, just like oil, there's a number and that's the energy it has. What you're talking about is how do you get it out and what's the efficiency of doing that. So here's one way to get it out of the wood, is to put in an outdoor wood boiler. This is David Blaze in Springfield, Vermont, along the Connecticut River. And he put in an outdoor wood furnace for all his heating sources. He used to burn fuel oil. He's got 4 greenhouses, a barn, a garage, a house. And so we did a little analysis of what's going on with that. He spent $8,000 on the furnace. And a lot of times people price things, they say, oh, that's reasonable. Well, by the time you put in all the insulated piping to get it from the furnace to the greenhouses, to the house, to the barn, to the garage, it's $20,000 more. I mean, and he didn't even buy the good stuff. It was like $17 a foot. So you could see some snow melting where he had the pipe under because it wasn't quite as efficient. But he is heating a lot of buildings. It took 50 cords of wood in that outdoor furnace for him to replace 3,500 gallons of heating oil. On the coldest nights, he said he burned almost 3 cords of wood.
I'm sorry, what's a cord of wood?
A cord is 4 by 4 by 8.
Okay.
Is a cube, you know, that's the cubic, that's the volume of it. It's just a standard measurement people use. So here's the thing, remember my criteria for analysis, the human element? The average farmer I work with does not want to be messing around with A, putting up 50 cords of wood, B, going out there at night, loading the food, blah, 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 blah. He's a logger. He's got all this junk wood around. He's got, you know, in the winter his greenhouses aren't being, you know, used, so he's putting up the wood. So that's kind of like the first place I start with. All this other analysis is nice. You don't want to handle that volume of wood. This system is not for you. For him, it's great. And he said to me he didn't think he'd be in business anymore if he hadn't switched over. He was, of course, looking at prices going up and up and up.
How do the prices compare between?
Well, let's do that right now. So let's start with the BTU usage and taking that number of how many from the first chart. He's wasting a lot of energy. This is not an efficient conversion. That furnace is not efficient. Remember I said the snow is melting over the place. So unlike his oil furnace, which is fairly efficient, he's losing a lot. Now that's not really fair because that number for the wood isn't accurate in BTUs for what he's burning. That was probably a hardwood cord of wood. He's burning some junk wood, some softwood, so it's probably more like 2 to 1. But he's wasting energy. Okay, the system's no good, right? It shouldn't be doing this. Well, it depends how you look at it. From a fossil fuel ratio, if you consider, it took him about 3 gallons of gas to cut the wood, to put it on his truck and move it in the 5 to 10 mile radius that he works in, and to put it, you know, he's not splitting it or anything because the furnace takes 6 foot lengths. So even that, it probably wasn't even 3 gallons, but that's, we're rounding things off here. 3 gallons of gas means it comes out to 23 to 1 fossil fuel ratio. For every unit of energy, fossil fuel he puts in, he gets 23 units of energy out from that wood. So that's pretty darn good number, actually, in most energy systems. How about greenhouse gas emissions? Well, if you average that a gallon of gas or oil generates 20 pounds of carbon dioxide when you burn it, it's actually 19 point something, but this makes it simple. So what is the source of CO2 equivalents from the wood in this calculation? Where does that come from?
Burning it and moving.
Yeah.
He says burning and moving. Is it from burning the wood? Do we count that as CO2 equivalents?
Mm. Or is it from the production, like getting it?
This is a really important point, really important thing to think about. What kind of CO2 is bad in terms of climate change?
Fossil CO2?
Fossil, right.
And this is renewable current CO2.
Right. So the way to think about it is there's above ground CO2 and there's below ground CO2. We don't count above ground CO2 in this. It's already in the system. It's going around and around and around. So when you burn a tree, are you adding more carbon dioxide to the CO2 system?
No.
No. You're adding it into the atmosphere on a short-term basis. It was going to go back there anyway. Sort of what's up here goes around and around and around. It's a little difficult concept for people because they say, well, it was sequestered in the tree. Well, sequestration is a short-term thing. And it was always 0.3 parts per million for the past 500,000 years or so anyway, as all the stuff went around and around. And that's soil organic matter, it's CO2 dissolved in the oceans, it's all, the difference is we've been sucking it out from underground and bringing it up here. That's how we've been raising the level. So the CO2 in this system comes from the gas that he burned to cut it, to move it. And if he'd been using biodiesel made 100% from soybeans, it would be almost an infinite ratio. Now, again, it gets complicated. There's energy embedded in all the equipment, blah, 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 blah. But from a simple point of view, 70 to 3 is the ratio for his system, which is it's a big reduction in CO2 equivalents. And then the cost, so if he's spending 50, counting 50 cords of wood at a $50 value, now again, he's not buying it, so this is his labor and the 3 gallons of gas and amortizing the equipment, versus that's what he paid for his 3,500 gallons of oil, almost $9,000. It's a 4.5 year payback. So there's all different ways to think about
this. Are those opportunity costs of wood, or is that the cost of actually going out and getting it?
Well, again, I'm keeping this at a rudimentary level, because you have his labor, and what's his labor really worth, and could he have been cutting wood for other people and selling it for $200 as cordwood? On the other hand, he's got this whole logging business, he's got all this equipment, it's the junk wood coming off, so that would be a good analysis to do. But what I'm saying here is these are rough approximations, just to give a sense of, and so I would have confidence that this is, 3 to 7 years, depending on how you want to calculate it. And also, we don't know so oil just went down. Is it going to be $5 in 2 years? There's a lot of...
Did you go through this process with him when he was...
I showed him afterwards what I did, yep. But a lot of it, I get the data, like, okay, how much gas do you think he used to... Well, I don't know, a couple of gallons. So we call it 3. I mean, I'm not trying to bias this in favor. We take very conservative numbers. And even the thing he did dispute on was the BTUs in the wood, because he was saying, I'm not using hardwood in this thing. I mean, that's what I sell, the hardwood.
So I have a couple questions.
Uh-huh.
The first is, what do you think about particulates?
Well, that's a great question. I'll go back to the... So this little sucker here is putting out some nasty stuff. And there's been some issues in Vermont regulatory-wise about particulates and where these can be sited. So that's a downside. If he were in a more suburbanized area, this would not be a system that would make sense. The fact that he's close to in the middle of nowhere, at least as far as immediate impact on neighbors, is reduced greatly. What the impact of putting those things into the sky in general and where they're going is definitely a downside on this kind of system. These furnaces theoretically could be cleaned up too. I mean, if they're more, and also the whole other thing that's really inherently wrong with them is they're made to kind of smolder. You get it hot, you put it in. If you could run them hot all the time, you'd use more wood, but they'd burn cleaner. All right, we got a bunch of other systems to go through here. Here's another wood system, totally different. This is a wood gasifier. So this is going to burn much cleaner. It's much more expensive. And this is an old one, actually. And guess what? The farmer doesn't even use it anymore. Here's a greenhouse. This is a Dutch design greenhouse, like a half an acre of tomatoes. Oh, there's a lot of money in this. There's a couple $100,000 of tomatoes at any one time during harvest. Guess what happens to tomatoes when it gets a little too cold? You've got a big problem. So when you turn this thing on, like, does the heat just blow out of the vents and warm up your greenhouse to the 3 more degrees you need immediately? No, the wood has to combust, the whole thing has to heat up. So basically it was not really the right design for this system. Now, we visited, I taught a renewable energy class at UVM last summer. We visited a sugar maker, Burr Morse, at East Montpelier. He's been using a gasifier for 14 years, totally satisfactory. But think about how you make maple syrup. You got all your sap, you fire the sucker up, and like you run it for, whatever, a couple days or a week, or at least certainly all night. And if it cools down, it cools down. You boil the stuff up, because nothing's going to die. And there's no quality issue of like the tomatoes getting chilling injury. So how the units are applied is important. But I'll show you, there's some other biomass ones, like I'll show you a corn furnace in a little while. Furnaces are getting better, and there's different ways to deal with it. So here's another fuel, waste vegetable oil. And some of the people I work with in greenhouses and some that have tractors been busy collecting waste vegetable oil from restaurants primarily. So this is good. We wanna use this stuff for energy if we can. There's a bunch of problems with it. One is the supply is limited. There's only so much, it's like estimated 200,000 gallons in all of Vermont or something. Mm-hmm. And then there are quality differences. So you can see some of these have a lot of, you know, they're more hydrogenated, or these are all made mostly from different vegetable crops. There might be some animal tallows in there. So all the different oils have different cloud points, which is at what temperature they start to solidify. So like canola can go down fairly low. Palm oil is at a much higher temperature, it gets solid. So when you're in a place like Vermont, that's a big deal. If you're gonna turn this into biodiesel or to burn it directly, you can't burn that in a tractor because it's going to plug, it's not gonna flow, it's not a liquid. So there are some issues there.
What do they burn this specific one?
I'll show you. So here's one way to do it, is you essentially get off the good stuff that you're gonna get, and you can have put in a waste oil burner. And these were designed originally to burn waste motor oil. And there are some farmers who are putting them in. This is attached to a greenhouse here. Mike Collins in Putney has several. And in this website I'll give you at the end, there's some case studies of all these farms with some of the numbers. Mike's is on there too. So that's one thing you can do, burn the waste oil directly.
Can it do both? Can it do waste oil and waste motor oil as well?
Yep. And it can do virgin vegetable oil,
mm-hmm.
which is, most of the people don't want to mess with motor oil,
because
now you've got a toxic waste on your farm, which changes a lot of things. Here's Mike's organic tomato greenhouse. It's all heated with waste vegetable oil. So one of the issues, of course, is collection. You've got to go out restaurant by restaurant, get 5 or 10 gallons at a time. For a vegetable grower, it works pretty well because for half the year, you might be making deliveries anyway.
Mm.
So there's no cost. So in the winter, you try and line it up with your chores or whatever into town. But for a lot of growers, and this is what's always fun when I go to conferences, you know, some people are really excited. Another farmer says, I'd never do that. You know, who the hell wants to go out every week collecting oil? Or, I got other things that would make me more money, you know, would make more sense to do. And it gets really complicated quick because there's also waste haulers that do the collecting, and there's a limited number of them, and they aren't so pleased when you leave the contract, and then you want to come back, and like they'll say, okay, this once, but don't come back again. This is your last chance. And the economics are totally changing. It's not really even a waste anymore. So it used to be you pay, debit, picked up. Now in places like Portland, Maine, there's a big farm that's been collecting all this, so now they're, and it was free, now the waste haulers are paying for it. They've got multi-million dollar rendering plants. They make this stuff into pet food and cosmetics, and they need this waste oil. So it's not gonna be a waste. And around here, the story is one farmer like Mike pretty much ties up Brattleboro to Bell's Falls of the restaurants that have the good stuff. A lot of these fast food franchises, it's hydrogenated, it's overused, it's not good for these systems. So that's great. We need a user in every town, any community doing it, but then we can't promote that method because it's saturated. So when you look at some economics on this, you got to buy the furnaces. That's a huge obstacle. A lot of the farmers I work with, they already have all the furnaces. So now Mike had to go out and buy 3 of these for $16.5, but it did offset 3,000 gallons of heating oil. Mentioned that already, and those. So when you push a number, okay, well, how do we figure the fossil fuel ratio? What fossil energy is he putting into the system?
Collecting the oil, driving around.
Collecting, that's pretty much it. So it's all, how far is he going? And then if he was going there anyway, do we count that?
Mm-hmm.
So this is, so it's something about once a week for half a year is, and 10 miles each way. I mean, if you want to, I didn't bother penciling it out because it's just guessing. We know how much CO2 equivalents we've offset from the waste oil. And then, so if we amortize the $16.5 over 10 years with an interest fee, and we get that cost per year, taking away what he was paying for the oil, he's saving $7,500 a year. Again, not counting now there's a little extra wear and tear on his truck. So his payback is about 3 years at 250 heating oil. Okay, well, another system. This farmer's collecting the same oil but making biodiesel. He's got greenhouses too. Why would he make biodiesel instead of going with the waste oil?
Burns.
Congeals in the better temperature.
Any other guesses?
Contains more energy.
Going. Think about his infrastructure.
It's less expensive.
Oh, you don't have to buy new furnaces.
Exactly. He's got 7 greenhouses that burn oil. 7 times $5,500. It's a lot of money to spend to save. It's a different scenario. Mike already had some other systems that weren't quite as expensive. So there's a bunch of reasons not to do this. One is there is one step in this process that's fairly dangerous. So to make biodiesel, you take vegetable oil plus alcohol and combine them in the presence of a catalyst like lye. You actually mix the alcohol and the lye first. You're making sodium methoxide or potassium methoxide. When you do that, you get a combustible gas, and people have burned their barns down. A guy in Western Mass did it. It was a big plant in California. It's totally preventable. There's sort of a hazardous control point analysis. We know, you know, and the guys that are doing this right now, they don't use anything that makes sparks, and everything's grounded. But you have to say this, you have to really explain, this is not something to mess with lightly. And it's not only combustible, it's toxic. You can kill yourself with this gas. So Wiz gives a lot of talks, and he does a really good job, comes out with his Tyvek and his goggles, and he mixes all the stuff outside. But this is how he started up, just in drums. You got a little paint mixer there, and he's mixing the lye and the methanol, and then it's being added to the oil. And what happens is you end up with biodiesel and glycerin. The glycerin settles to the bottom, and you pull that off. It's separate. That's your byproduct. And then there's all kinds of things you can burn it in. So once, basically, anything that runs on diesel will run on biodiesel, assuming it's not too cold, and the biodiesel is gonna gel. Why is it too cold? So tractors, irrigation. People are running their cars. There's more and more Mercedes on organic farms now, old Mercedes. But here's the heaters he has. So there's an oil-fired heater. And these are all been converted to biodiesel. It doesn't take that much converting. One thing is the biodiesel flame is less bright than a regular heating oil flame. So there's a shutoff. It's the sensor senses there's no flame and it shuts down. So they paint the inside of that little combustion chamber with silver paint, so that there's greater luminescence and the sensors keep going. So that's one thing. And then filtering, because you might have a little more junk in your bodies. But anyway, the next logical step was to grow our own oil and our own sugar crops to make our own alcohol. And this is where I started getting really excited. I visited a farm that was dubbing around with this, and since then we've got a bunch of grants, and I'll show you we've started to do this and starting to scale it up. So this is the total sustainability and energy independence. If you're not depending on waste oil, you're not buying oil, you're not buying alcohol. Methanol costs like $3 a gallon right now, so you have to buy that too. So one of the things we started looking into agronomically is, well, what crops would you grow to get oil? And canola is one of the logical choices. You have these little pods, and inside are all these little dark seeds that are 40% oil. And so this is not new. Canola is grown in Canada and Northwest, Upper Midwest for a long time, but figuring out how to grow them in Vermont has been what we've been looking at. So this is a field of canola this past summer in Shaftesbury, Vermont, just a little north of Bennington. This farmer had already grown little bits, but this year we did like 40 to 50 acres of all different crops, canola, mustard, flax, sunflower, and then sweet sorghum and sugar beets and a little bit of Jerusalem artichokes for sugar crops. But some places you just grew big fields. This is actually a field of trials, so there's 6 varieties of canola in here in strips, and we're seeing how they yield and the different pest pressure and stuff they have. And that's
so when you do trials with them, do you support them financially or anything like that, or have they just agreed to try with you?
it's a complicated thing. We ended up getting money for him to buy equipment that I'll show you. He's putting his own labor and land in. There's a whole bunch of different ways to do it. He's getting a lot of stuff, but he's contributed a ton of labor, and frankly, this wouldn't be happening. His expertise, there's a couple of guys involved in this. And also, these are just large strips that integrate a lot of variability. They're like a tenth of an acre each. Up north, working with the extension agronomist Heather Darby, we did replicated trials at Smolenska. But I'm more interested in sort of taking the quantum leap of, once we see that mustard gave half the yield of canola, seeing the statistical validity of the difference among the mustards is just irrelevant to me. Now, once we know, okay, it's canola and sunflower, now we're going to fine tune it with more trials. So there's the canola, and then you get those little pods that I showed you. Pretty quick, like within a month, this is a sea of pods, and then like 3 weeks later, after the pods form, they dry down and look like this. So there's a whole complex thing of how do you harvest these. We have a combine, but even that, it's not so simple. You know, when you get extension literature from places that grow this stuff, Saskatchewan and North Dakota, you know, like 50-page booklets on adjusting your combine to get the, and because we leave a lot in the field, this, you got all these little dry pods, combine is a paddle, it whacks them and the pods go all over, you know, so you're leaving 5-10% in the field, that's not good, so we're working on that. Fortunately, John Williamson, who I'm working with, has all this mechanical know-how, so he was all excited when he gained 20 years. He was using his father's 1947 combine, then he bought this 1965 combine, but he bought this for $1,000 from a neighbor, took it all apart for $1,000 in belts and bearings, put it all back together, made it work. So that's a huge factor, because to go out and buy a new combine, it's like $100,000. I mean, it's just crazy. So he's been able to do all these things that let this trial work. But you can see the paddles, they come in, they knock all these pods, seeds off, collect all the seed in the bin, and then spit all the chaff while the rest of the plant out back in the field. Combines are pretty neat things. We also grew sunflowers, three different varieties, and working at the University of New Hampshire, grew six varieties and two different planting dates. So that's what they look like. Of course, they can't be harvested there. You have to let them all dry down. And a lot of this gets tricky too, because the moisture has to be low enough in the seed so that you can harvest it and store it. If it's got too much moisture or too much weedy chaff in it, it's going to heat up, starts to compost, and then ruins the seed. So we were waiting for them to dry down. So we put up all this canola seed in the barn. And he had done little trials when I first visited him, and this was about where they'd gotten to. All right, what do you do next?
Crush them.
How do you crush them? Well, it turns out there's little like third world hand crank things, or you have to drive them to Canada to the nearest crusher, commercial crusher. So he said, oh, well, I don't want to be driving to Canada. That's not sustainable, and there goes all our profit and fossil fuel out the window. So they had been looking around for a press, and that's the first thing I did was we got some money to buy this neat little Swedish seed press. It's computer controlled, it's cost $9,000, and they built this big hopper, the seed goes in here, all the oil comes out here, and then you get this stuff, which is seed meal, which is a valuable livestock feed. And in fact, this is one of the exciting things on these projects. This may end up being worth more than the oil. It probably is. Probably now it's worth like twice per acre. And the whole soybean biodiesel industry really is driven by feed from soy with oil as a byproduct. Mm. And so by making it into fuel, they're just adding value to what's close to a waste. So we started getting into all these different analyses of the forage value now, sunflower meal,